I am Suleiman Bashir Gheyn. I'm a professor of philosophy. I was trained as a philosopher in France. And I am a Senegalese. I taught for roughly 20 years back in Dakar, in Senegal, after my higher education was completed in France. And after that, I crossed the Atlantic and taught for a few years at Northwestern University in the Department of Philosophy and the Program of African Studies and Religion. And I've joined Columbia University in 2008, and now I'm a faculty here at Columbia University in the departments of French and Francophone Studies and also Philosophy.
When did you cross the Atlantic?
I crossed the Atlantic in 1999.
Yes.
I was first invited. I was a visiting professor at Northwestern University when I was invited for one just one quarter, and after that I discussed with the friends who invited me there, who told me that their plan was actually to bring me to Northwestern University. I hesitated a lot because I had not stayed in France after my higher education.
Yeah.
France in many ways is also my country.
It is. You studied there.
I studied
in École Normale, so
at École Normale it was easier for me probably to to try to start my career there. But I wanted to go back to Senegal. I thought that I owed it to Senegal to go back and contribute to the philosophy department there, where I created a curriculum in the field of logic, the philosophy of mathematics, which was my first my first field. And I created also a curriculum in Islamic philosophy.
You did.
And you might be interested in actually in the reasons why that was the case, because I was not formally trained in the field of Islamic philosophy. But I went back to Dakar in the early 1980s, and this was the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution.
Yes.
And we started seeing on our campus women who would wear veils, and so we realized that some form of political Islam was being present in the country, and we thought that it was our responsibility as a Department of Philosophy to make sure that we teach a tradition, an intellectual and spiritual tradition in Islam, which was rationalist, which was skeptical, which was open, pluralistic, and tolerant.
Yes.
And it seemed important for us to do that. So we decided that we would teach that. Nobody was a specialist. I was trained as a philosopher of science and a logician, but somehow by through my family background, because of my family background, I belong to a family of let's say scholars, Muslim scholars, and I got some informal training in that field with my father, so I was able to hold the position and to basically train myself getting better and better and better in that field, which is now one of the fields
I write philosophy on Islam.
And which is now translated into English and will be coming out under the title Open to Reason.
Did you choose the title?
Actually, it was suggested to me by Columbia University Press, and I'm very happy that they know how to choose titles. I adopted it as soon as it was proposed to me by Columbia University Press. And so this is how I became also a specialist in the field. And after 20 years teaching at Sheikh Abdul Jabbar University, when those colleagues and friends of mine at Northwestern University asked me to, basically the argument that was presented to me and which convinced me ultimately was that 20 years teaching was truly a career. I had somehow earned the right, probably, to for a second part of my career to work in conditions that were easier for me to be more productive even in what I was doing.
So I have already like three or four questions, not necessarily in order, but so first of all, you said you think you owed to Senegal, and that seems to me, maybe I am wrong, I am not sure, but you will tell me, it seems to me at the same time an ethical debt and a political debt.
Yes.
So both are important to me, and I would like for you to elaborate a little bit on them. The second question is related to the program in Islamic philosophy, which so you were, you say you are an expert, or you were at that moment only an expert in logic and philosophy of science, not necessarily Islamic logic and philosophy of science, but in general, right?
In general.
But I guess that also when you delved into the this world of Islamic philosophy, and in particular in the field of history of Islamic philosophy, then you realized that it was part of your expertise as well, I guess.
Indeed.
No?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. Uh-huh. Let me start with this question.
Okay.
Actually,
sure.
This is exactly what happened.
Uh-huh.
I have grown next to a father who was himself really just devouring books after books.
And what did he do? He was a scholar.
He was a scholar of Islam, but at the same time, he was a civil servant for the government of Senegal. I mean, he worked in post offices, my father and my mother.
My father was in the post office.
You see? Something we share.
Yeah.
Actually, he was supposed to be trained to become an imam and a Muslim scholar.
Yeah.
And he decided when he was 12 that he wanted to go to the French school.
Uh-huh.
This was under colonial...
Right.
Colonialism, obviously, and so yes, he went to school. Eventually, did some professional training to become a postman.
Yes.
And so I have traveled throughout Senegal when I was a child, from post office to post office, given the responsibilities of my father. But he also had the training of an Islamic scholar. So that was his true life, I would say. I've always seen him during weekends, for example, having friends of his come and learn from him, commenting the Quran, reading books in Islamic studies, and so on and so forth. So
Speaking in Arabic.
Yeah, he knew Arabic. So I grew up in that atmosphere, and I would, for example, read the books that he had in his library and discuss them with him. So when it was decided that we would create this curriculum in Islamic philosophy, I was already familiar with a certain number of topics and with obviously the names and certain works by Al-Ghazali, Ibn Sina, and so on and so forth. So it was easy for me to go in that direction and start teaching the material. But this is when I started also really reflecting on Islam as an intellectual and a spiritual tradition myself. So I was learning as I was teaching, which is basically what we do in academia.
Well, So the second part is then your ethical and political debt to Senegal was
yes. I at the time when I went to France, I had a scholarship by the Senegalese government, and it seemed to me just the right thing to do after studying there to go back home. I mean, I was successful enough to be the first Senegalese Normalien at the Cordon Supérieur, and I was also working on a very technical in a very technical field. I did my dissertation on the algebra of logic Boolean algebra of logic.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have made sense to say, okay, I'm going to stay in France where I can have the interlocutors to be in conversation about this particular very technical field in which I am. But as I said, I thought, okay, Senegal has actually trained me for all my elementary and high school. They sent me to France to be better trained for my higher education, giving me this scholarship and so on. I owe it to go back.
Yes.
And it might be difficult to find the right interlocutors back home to talk about philosophy of science, logic, etc. But after all, as a professor, I'm going to train my interlocutors, which is what I did.
Mm-hmm. You have to invent them in
exactly
a certain way.
After a while, I had this seminar, this graduate seminar on precisely logic, philosophy, history of science, and we started at a certain point with a couple of colleagues and my graduate students, my PhD students. We started writing together.
Oh wow!
Volumes in the one of the two works I'm most proud of are two volumes that I edited with only a couple of colleagues and my own PhD students. And I'm very proud that now the two courses I've created, which is in the field of logic, philosophy of science, and in the field of Islamic philosophy, are now being taught by former students of mine. So this is the reason why I felt when I was back in the early 2000, I felt that yes, indeed, I had contributed, and I could at that point, after 20 years, feel allowed to just be in the U.S. and work in the kind of elite universities like Northwestern and Columbia, where I am now, where I obviously work in much better conditions. I am more productive, and this is still Senegalese philosophy. I still represent Senegalese philosophy.
Yes. So, so in a certain way, then when you went back to Senegal, you also had to invent your fields. You had to teach, train, and in a certain way invent also the interlocutors. Did you have to invent academic freedom itself? Did you have to invent a different way, or not? I don't know.
No.
To address, you know, that kind of specific liberty we have when we are in that environment, in the university environment.
I must say that in Senegal itself, I did not have to.
You didn't have to.
For Senegal is was and still is a very particular country in on the African continent, and especially in our region, because of a tradition, a certain tradition of academic freedom, and a tradition of multi-party politics and so on and so forth. There was a solid democratic tradition in Senegal that the political power respected. University and academic freedom and possibility to write and teach freely was. But I was also living in Africa, going to other places in Africa. I remember the first time after I went back to Senegal, I traveled to Benin, then under the regime of Mathieu Kérékou. I remember talking with my good friend and mentor, Paul Nkuntonji, who's a really famous African philosopher, and in a cafe. And at one point he had to hush me. And told me, we're not in Senegal. It's not always good to have the kind of conversation we are having out loud like this. This is when I realized that this is back in the 1980s. After that, Benin has very much changed.
Yes.
The rest of Africa had gone through the so-called democratic transition.
Yes.
But this is when I realized
mm-hmm.
the mm-hmm. price, really, the price and the value of academic freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But oh my goodness, there is not such a thing in Senegal. You could say anything.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an academic on campus, you could say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And be sure that you will go.
Mm-hmm. And it's
home.
Still a public
and
education.
It is still a public education.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And but the government.
Yes.
Decides not to interfere with academia.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Now,
mm-hmm.
now,
mm-hmm.
something that also happened during the time, and this is connected with the reasons why we had this meeting in my department and decided to teach Islamic philosophy.
Uh-huh.
I had a colleague who was teaching who was a philosophy teacher in high school, as
yes.
you know, in the French system.
Mm-hmm.
The
so the Senegalese and the French system are modeled the
modeled
same way?
After the French system.
Okay.
So, one day this colleague, who was also a friend,
mm-hmm.
was attacked by a student who said that he had insulted God. So academic freedom
mm-hmm.
was to be defended now not against a state which was not actually threatening it,
yes.
but somehow from within
mm-hmm.
because of the kind of fanaticism
mm-hmm.
that was developing also
mm-hmm.
in the society and was reaching campuses.
Okay.
So this is one. Another way of looking at academic
yes.
freedom. So our decision to say we are going to teach a rationalist,
mm-hmm.
skeptical, open, pluralistic tradition
mm-hmm.
of Islam.
But not atheistic.
And not atheistic.
Secular in some way.
Exactly.
Perplexingly secular in some way.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And basically teaching our students that even faith
mm-hmm.
needs questioning
yes.
and skepticism. And academic freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot have faith if you do not have the possibility to challenge
mm-hmm.
Received ideas, assumptions, and interpretations.
Yes.
So that was another experience of academic freedom
mm-hmm.
in this particular case. Not the idea that it could be threatened not by the state
mm-hmm.
in general, but by some parts of aspects of what was happening in the society
mm-hmm.
at the time.
Is it still going on, this kind of strange interaction in which there is this religious or fanatic power that...
Yeah, there are from time to time. I mean, in the case of Senegal,
yes.
I have to say that the tradition of secularism is really... there. It's really a tradition.
Yes.
One. Second, the particular interpretation of Islam that is pervasive is Sufism.
Yes.
So it means that the tradition, the Islamic tradition itself, is open and tolerant. So,
mm-hmm.
so there is no huge threat
uh-huh.
in that sense
mm-hmm.
in society. But you do have the presence of certain organizations who are for certain form of interpretation of Islam that are against
mm-hmm.
academic freedom, basically,
mm-hmm.
and not so tolerant.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I have a colleague who now has passed away, unfortunately, a couple of years ago, who was attacked because of a book he wrote about, and the book was about the influence of Greek thought
mm-hmm.
in the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that's fascinating.
That was fascinating.
Yes.
So this is not something I was not thinking in those ways, and I thought that there were flaws in the,
right.
in the book, but I did not expect the kind of reaction
uh-huh.
that it generated, where in the news of papers, many people wrote about their outrage, and you did have people who called for basically killing him. And
really?
Started using the B word, blasphemy. And so so it means that those people are in society and they are not ready to discuss anything.
Right.
They are not for freedom of discussion and expressing one's ideas and you know submitting them to scrutiny and discussion, but would even call for the killing of somebody. And that was also something we had to take into account, saying that, well, this kind of reaction can exist in a country like Senegal, where there is secularism, as I say, and also the particular brand of Islam there is very much a Sufi.
So do you think that in a certain way some of the things that you are saying about that particular moment and those particular events in Senegal are taking place not with Islamic fanatics, but rather with Christian ones here in this country?
Absolutely. That is, you know, these fanatics, my sense is that they have a religion of their own. And that religion could very well be called Islam or Christianity or Judaism or Hinduism. Fanaticism is a religion. And now we have this, in this country, we do have this connection between those Christian fanatic ideas and the general ideology of ethno-nationalism. I am just appalled to see that people can even evoke Christianity in defense of somebody who very probably is a pedophile.
Yes.
So
are you referring to that kind of the Roy Moore person?
The Roy Moore person who is very likely going to be elected a senator.
I see.
And I mean, he's accused by many women of molesting them while they were obviously minors. And not judging, deciding that he is guilty, but the discourse saying that even if he were, is just frightening.
It is.
And coming from a party that is supposed to be holding very high family values.
Yes. So and Christian values.
And Christian values. So it means that instrumentalizing religion actually is widespread. And fanaticism, as I have said, is a religion of its own.
Yeah.
All these fanatics, they can come from very different religion, but they share the same narrow and actually murderous way of thinking that they are right and everybody else is wrong.
So, questions that relate to both your experience in Senegal and your experience in the United States is, to what extent these kind of actions or against intellectual and academic freedom, to what extent do they entail forms of censorship that are not just external censorship, but they're in the end up being internal, like self-censorship?
Absolutely. You know, My wife had decided at one point to wear a kind of headscarf, and I remember having thought at one point, asking her, urging her to remove it.
Really?
Yes. And I thought, my goodness, you are going to ask your
partner of life, yes,
to, you know, renounce the choice of putting a headscarf on because you want her to hide somehow that she's Muslim, because you are now censoring her own self, being afraid for her. I was just thinking, okay, we're in New York.
Yes, we are.
New York means we are protected from certain forms of, but
we hope we are.
Things, stuff happens, and I was thinking, okay, somebody, some crazy guy could just, you know, say something to her or even do something because of her headscarf.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, I hope that I'm not censoring myself in that same way in the name of prudence.
Mm-hmm.
And in the name of prudence, we might end up, putting a censor into our own heads.
Yes.
And which would be the negation of who we are as academics.
Mm-hmm.
And I would actually, in that sense, betray the very reasons why I decided to become an expert in Islamic philosophy.
That's right. That's right.
It would be
ironic. Yes. So it's not a secret that, and we were talking about that before we started the recording, it's not a secret that there is a growing anti-academicism and anti-intellectualism that is going on in this country, that is being targeted.
Yes. Anti-intellectualism was there. We know that, yes, somehow you have to pretend that you are not an intellectual. Look at one of the attacks that were very personal against Barack Obama was to say that he was calling him even professor of Obama seemed to be an insult and a political argument to call him that way. So anti-intellectualism were used to that somehow. But it is clear, I believe, that, for example, the budgetary decisions are targeting university. Because you might think, okay, we have to convince these people and the society at large that universities are a common good, social good. And then you realize it is not about explaining. The people who are targeting universities know what they do.
Mm-hmm.
When they decide that budget for, you know, endowing humanities and so on and so forth could be, you know, just taken out of the budget. It is not that they do not realize what university means. It is that they are really realizing what they are doing. They know what they are doing, and they are targeting universities because they consider that these are bastions for the opposition in general. So this idea that politics is about, you know, fighting enemies. And that you can consider that the press, which basically informs us about facts, or university, which teach critical thinking, are enemies. That is something frightening, scary.
So it seems like instead of research, instead of facts, instead of that, there is a renaissance of opinion, and that's, it's interesting because in a certain way can we say that this renaissance of opinion is in fact a regression to ignorance in a certain way, but it's a regression to lack of freedom.
Absolutely, because we are discovering two fundamental truths upon which a discipline like mine, philosophy, is founded.
Mm-hmm.
One is that you have to make sure that you actually pull the truth out of the opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Opinion is just that, an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It is not the truth. And critical thinking, the philosophical approach, is to move out of opinion to reach something like the truth, and to create an agreement of reasonable people around a notion of truth. That's one fundamental aspect of philosophy and the humanities and critical thinking and one of the pillar of universities. The second one is that actually, yes, truth frees us, liberates us. Truth is liberation and is emancipation.
Mm-hmm.
And so now when we live in a time where people are saying in a very cynical way that there is not such a thing as truth, but just interpretation.
But they are doing it cynically.
They are doing it cynically. Using that,
mm-hmm.
You cannot have something more cynical than a reflection I just heard on television coming from the spokesperson of the White House, saying that even if videos are not true, they still make sense because they are addressing the so-called threat of Islam. So if you say, even if it is not true, you cannot be more cynical than that.
No.
So
obviously there is on the one hand these trends of anti-intellectualism, anti-academicism. That do you think addresses only or targets only the humanities?
No. I think it's much larger than that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the humanities, because in the humanities are precisely built around this notion of skepticism. Don't take things just like that and be critical and always seeking some firm ground,
mm-hmm.
and denouncing everything shaky, precisely as shaky.
Mm-hmm.
That would be really the obvious target.
Mm-hmm.
But behind that, this is the expression of the spirit of education in general itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we have here to come back to the etymology of education.
Mm-hmm.
Educare, conduct, pull people out of ignorance into knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to come back to those basic ideas that there is such thing as ignorance, and that we are being a human being is always coming out of that ignorance and trying as much as we can to enter the space of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And that our humanity is at stake, and there is this relationship between our humanity and the humanities.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, that spirit which is so obvious in the humanities, upon which the humanities are built,
mm-hmm.
is actually the spirit of anything having to do with
yeah.
education, be it in engineering or in chemistry.
Yeah.
Agreement of spirits and rational beings on facts and truth is some ethical foundation of any kind of research, be it in the field of humanities or the hard sciences, as they are called.
So one of the reasons why I started this project is because I felt that it was my political duty to poll people from very different backgrounds, from the very different educations, from very different countries and languages and whatnot, about that, because in a certain way I was afraid that the movements that we see targeting every single one of our conquests, social, political, liberal, educational, etc., you know, that somehow people tend to normalize that. That 4 years is enough time for people to forget about how was it before, and then perpetuate that. So do you think we are already normalizing something? What are the things that we should not normalize, that we are risking now normalizing?
Well, for one, we are witnessing
mm-hmm.
these attacks
mm-hmm.
on principle that we thought that we took for granted,
mm-hmm.
freedom of religion.
Yes.
We thought that this was something absolutely out of question. You cannot question that. But we are seeing people being targeted because of their religion, with very little, you know, clothing of the reasons why they are targeted. I mean, if we look at things, we do have a Muslim ban, no matter how you call it.
Yeah, no matter how many South American countries you include in this,
yes,
it's still a Muslim ban.
It is still a Muslim ban, because it was announced as such, and it was realized following that kind of promise. And so we are getting used to a certain number of things that one wake-up call. I could not have thought that it was possible for in our time to see Nazis march and say things like blood and soil. And now we would say these were clowns, but the very possibility of those clowns is actually the fact that they feel that this is their time. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they feel and think that this is their time is that many things that we consider to have been, you know, granted once and for all,
yes,
we do not even give them a second thought, are now being questioned.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the climate in which we are living now.
Mm. And those Nazis are very purposely targeting universities as well. They are marching on campus.
Exactly.
They are marching on campus.
And exactly. And they are actually, in a very cynical way, again, I come back to that word,
mm-hmm,
using the very notion of freedom of expression.
Yeah.
And in a way, they are playing with it. They are kind of testing it. Here in our university, for example, we had this this British right-wing person who built reputation and the part and his party,
mm-hmm,
upon Islamophobia. That's what he did, just attack Islam. And he was invited to speak to this campus. And there was a reaction coming from many students, especially the Muslim Students Association, the MSA. And that was the goal. In other words, you say something outrageous, or you invite someone who has nothing precise to say, except how much they hate a certain target. And that's the whole thing. And in fact, you count on the kind of reaction that you can generate among students and so on and so forth to say, oh, here I am coming in the name of freedom of expression, and here are these people who are against the freedom of expression. But you are not expressing anything. You do not need to express anything. Just be who you are and say a few words of hatred, and expect and hope for the reaction of the people who are outraged, mm-hmm, and express their outrage in order for you to be the victim of the very notion of freedom of expression that you do not care at all about. And this is what makes it so tricky. And my sense, what I say to the people who ask me for advice is to say, we have to hold dear the principle of freedom of expression.
Mm.
Make sure that these people, if they are saying that they come,
mm,
in the name of the freedom of expression, they can express themselves. Actually, if you are just too quiet and let them speak, you would realize they have nothing to say. And this is what is so tricky with the freedom of expression. We live at a time when people who do not care about freedom of expression because of their own ideology are playing with it, just saying, well, let me say this and see what the reaction of the people is going to be. We had that at the time of the caricature of those drawings about the Prophet Muhammad. When a certain number of newspapers decided to reproduce them just to sort of try, test the freedom of expression. What does it mean to test it? That means you are waiting and you are expecting the kind of outrage to express itself. You need it in some respect. So this is where we have to make sure that we hold the principle of freedom of expression. Make sure that we never suppress it, no matter how much outrage we feel from what is being said and what is just insult and nothing expressed truly, and have our own academic response to those.
Okay. And let it be an academic
and
response?
Let it be an academic response.
Okay. But on the other hand, and this is just a question. So, why should we respect freedom of expression, given that we are not state actors? So, freedom of expression was designed, and it's inscribed in the Bill of Rights, as a freedom for people to say whatever they want and not be persecuted by the state.
Right.
But we are not state actors.
That's true.
So, we can interrupt. Can we? So, it's true, and I agree totally with you, with the fact that, okay, if you let them speak, and you just sit back and say, okay, talk, they won't have anything to say.
No.
And whatever they have to say will be embarrassing for everybody, including themselves.
Exactly.
And yet, they will, even if no reaction, of if we turn that into a non-event, as we have been discussing in some cases, will they find in the current moment of crazy age of communication and social media, will they find nevertheless some sort of platform to grow their that kind of hatred speech, illusion of white supremacy, illusion of preeminence of Christianity, and so on and so forth. So even if we let them speak, or if we let them speak, won't we in a certain way also helping them grow their platform?
I can understand that actually either way there is a win for those people in this kind of situation. Either you react to it, you prevent them from speaking and they say voila, or you let them speak, and obviously this is not something also you want to, because the kind of platform in this anti-intellectual atmosphere and in this atmosphere where people are ready to take for true something they find in the social media, etc., it might be dangerous. So in this case, what you have to evaluate is where do you lose most?
Yes.
In what kind of situation? Because the expression of the outrage becomes something that even the normal media would be actually reporting on. Letting them have this kind of win, comforting their own base about who they are and what they are saying in this case, it seems to me it's very difficult, obviously. Somehow you would even have to decide on an ad hoc basis, but precisely because you can't do that, just to keep holding the principle. Suck it up.
Okay.
Hold the principle. It seems to me that's the best way to.
So for instance, when the Republicans on campus invited that person, I don't even remember his name.
Exactly.
I don't even remember his name.
He's
he doesn't have a name.
He's a nobody.
He's an evil nobody. So there was a very strange reaction on the part of the university, of the powers of the university, of provost, of, they came up with
disciplinary. So what do you think about that?
That was, you know, I was in a meeting where we discussed that aspect of things, and that was the worst type of reaction, I think, because you could have delivered the same content
mm-hmm.
in a different way, but just reminding people that they are liable and exposed to punishment if they react to something that is itself designed and meant to make people react was not the best way of presenting the case. I understand that the university had to remind everybody that of the principle of freedom of expression and say that you do not condone in any way that kind of speech, but you want to let it be
mm-hmm.
and be possible on campus because that is the meaning of what a campus is. But this was really, really, at least, very bizarre
mm-hmm.
way of saying that. They
mm-hmm.
did not need to emphasize punishment. And in the end, they had to abandon the kind of pursuit
they
had started against students who were just expressing the fact that they are not feeling that it is right for them to be insulted in their very space
mm-hmm.
Where they live and where they should feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a different way of speaking to them
mm-hmm.
and to speaking to that the difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
of the notion of freedom of expression, because it seems so easy to just say, okay, as long as something you have to say is not harming directly people, you're free
yeah.
to say it. But then define harm.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And so, you know, showing your own community that you fully understand where these people are coming
mm-hmm.
from, what they are trying to achieve by just bringing in someone who has nothing interesting or debatable
has no academic qualifications anything,
and that you are actually and realize that you are inviting him just because he is mm. Islamophobic and he
yes
yeah and so that would have been a better way to handle the whole situation.
But do you think that this somehow can cloud? So even if they had to abandon it, which means that they couldn't discipline those students, that the backlash was too big
mm-hmm.
for them to continue with this stupid
mm-hmm.
reaction
mm-hmm.
of the punitive society, which has been going on a lot in this university in the last few years. And we've seen it last year. There were other students who occupied Low Library and for the fossil asking the university to divest from fossil fuel, they were disciplined. They did absolutely nothing but protest
mm-hmm.
in the way protests go on. So
mm-hmm.
they disturb
mm-hmm.
they disrupt
mm-hmm.
the business as usual. That's
mm-hmm.
what you do.
That's
the
definition.
Way
yeah
that's so. So in a certain way, so and also our president Lee Bollinger presents himself as the champion of First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a scholar in First
mm-hmm.
Amendment. So I see that some of these people who are in power are testing to what whether they can somehow discipline or prevent something from happening, or advise through different centers and through different offices across campus. Do you think that there is a cloud of curtail, subtle sometimes, of academic intellectual freedom that is approaching the campus? Or do you think this is not going to happen?
I am afraid that something that is happening more generally, the
mm-hmm.
idea of suppressing protest,
okay.
forgetting that protest also
mm-hmm.
is expression,
yeah.
and that should be free. And mm-hmm. protest is part of the way in which society should be functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm afraid that that aspect of things which is growing generally is also reaching campuses.
Mm-hmm.
You would have thought that campuses would be protected against that.
Yes.
And that campuses would have, because they are campuses precisely, would have integrated the culture of protest. And now, if the rest of the society is about discipline and punish,
mm-hmm.
this should not be the case on campuses. But I'm afraid, and I agree with what you were saying, that this is, you know, creeping
mm-hmm.
into campuses as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of protest I've seen, the disciplining that kind of protest because students were occupying the library and disturbing a little the normal functioning of things. Isn't that something that we can definitely
mm-hmm.
you know cope with in our university? Did we need to be so punitive
mm-hmm.
Against that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
So in this, so you come from a public education structure both in France and in Senegal.
Mm-hmm.
I come from a public education system in Spain and in France. And my first job here in the United States was in Berkeley, it was public education. And Northwestern is a private institution?
It is a private
institution. It is a private institution. So your experience here is mostly in private
institutions.
Private
institutions, that's right.
But, you know, one expects that public is public.
Yes.
Right? That there is no interference, that there is, you know, that the very people who populate the university are the ones who constitute the machinery of the university, and with no external interference or disruption. So, and more or less is the case in some countries, in Senegal, as you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
in France a little bit, with ups and downs,
mm-hmm.
in Spain with ups and downs, after, of course, the death of Franco. But in this country, you know, you have the donors, you have the trustees, you have this board that somehow overlooks the university, and that plays a very strange role,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, to what extent do you think, you know, these are... So what can we do with that? I don't know. It's because they seem to be the ones also who earmark money
mm-hmm.
by giving specific donations,
yes.
who in a certain way ask the president and the board and the executive committee and whatnot to, you know, consider things. The ones who in the end, for instance, grant tenure, it's the board of trustees who grants tenure. How do we work with that?
It is, well, let me put this in a larger even setting.
Yes.
I'm amazed by the fact that the most advanced democracy
mm-hmm.
is actually allowing money and donors to play such a huge role in the first place.
Yes.
The idea that the most public and the most common of all public and common goods, which is just living together and deciding freely who we are going to elect, might be more than influenced by donors, people who put money in on this candidate or that candidate,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so forth. And not only do that, but at the same time want the people who are elected to vote a certain way in making decisions. So if society, democracies are functioning like that, there is something wrong. And you want to believe that universities are not working the same way. Let me give you an example.
Yes.
Here in our institution.
Mm-hmm.
I know that a colleague of ours who was the head of IRCPL, which is a very fine institute here, Institute for Religion, Culture, and Public Life, doing great job in the reflection on religion and society and public life and so on and so forth. It seems, I am speaking here because I don't know exactly things, but it seems like the daughter who started that wasn't happy with her at one point and got her actually really fired from that position of being the director of that is how our colleague felt.
She even left.
And if that can happen on a campus where a donor, because they are a donor, can decide the academic, the very precise, the minutiae of the academic orientation of a certain institution, then we have a problem.
Yeah.
We want to think that this kind of influence of money on the orientation of what should be public concern doesn't happen in a space dedicated to freedom of expression and to free inquiry. And because that is the responsibility of academics. We need to be trusted in exercising the freedom of expression we are normally guaranteed to have, seeking the common good and freely considering what we should be inquiring about, what we should be searching. So we don't want to think that you have this huge influence of dogs. So I'm giving here an extreme case of a direct intervention of a donor on the functioning of a one given institution. But you have more subtle ways of doing this. You do not have this kind of intervention, you just have these trustees decide. So to what extent would you refrain from intervening in academic orientation if you are giving money? This should not be a question left to the personal ethics of a person. It should be something that we are guaranteed not to happen by the institution itself.
Yes.
It's not just because I'm ethical, I refrain from deciding exactly what I want to be done academically with the money I'm putting down.
Yes. So how do you, for instance,
have this conversation if you do in your classroom? Is it something that you feel that questions of academic freedom or of freedom of speech or trigger warnings, even things like that, play a role in your class, in your everyday life in the classroom?
I'm trying to think about instances where it came up in classes, because this is not something you as faculty also, it is our responsibility not to come in class with our own preoccupations and sort of just bringing down and presenting to the students out of the blue. These things have to come out naturally in the course of the classroom. And I don't remember having had to discuss these particular issues in my class. I have had to discuss these issues with students because of their own organization. I mean, I mentioned earlier the MSA. Muslim Students Association, because of the kind of classes I teach in the tradition, the free, skeptical, rationalist tradition of Islamic thinking, etc., they have developed a kind of relationship with me where they could seek my advice for this or that. These are, for example, instances where I can have with them, with the students, the kind of discussion we are having about these principles. Yes.
So we've been recording for over 1 hour. And
goodness.
Yes. Goes fast.
Goes fast. Yeah.
But I don't want to take much more of your time, and we're still, we need to take the last portrait. But I want you to tell me, so how what do we do? What is the one thing that you would like me to take with me so that I can forget? Not what is my responsibility, because each of us is the only one who can pinpoint and understand and work with this responsibility. We do have one.
We do.
A very important one. But so, you know, what would be your conclusion, your central idea, the one thing you want me to keep with me and then think of it, reflect on that?
You know, something that emerged in from our conversation, this is not something I had in mind prior to our conversation, but something that emerged because we have discussed all these things, is the need in which we are to understand that you've mentioned our responsibility. It is our responsibility to make sure that we fight academically a certain number of things that are happening now. The need to fight, because it is a combat. As we said earlier, there are things that we considered out of reach of anything, and we considered granted, and we realize that they are not. It means also that having to fight is something we should be realizing. Certain ideas need to be fought by us on our own terms, which are academic terms. It means that we have to fight them, unfortunately, also now on our own campuses. We need to be organized to do that. Just an example.
Yes.
You mentioned the role of donors. It means that on the other side, we have to be organized in such a way that we remind all donors that academia is academia.
Yeah.
And that academic freedom means also that these people that we call faculty have the responsibility to be fully responsible for the orientation of their own research. And that doesn't have to come from outside. And the only way in which we can articulate this response is if it is an organized response.